a glass of ice water, then touched the paper napkin to her lips. It's hot in here, right? Or maybe it's me, I'm nervous. She pinched the round collar of her blouse away from her neck and fanned it back and forth. I'm nervous, but I'm also that age. I can say that to you, right? You're a doctor, even though you look like you should still be in high school. Are you really a doctor? I am. There was no point getting into that one. Well, that's good. I'm glad. Your parents would have been proud of that. Can I say something else? I'm sitting here looking at you. Your face is perfectly fine. I don't know what I was expecting, but there isn't a mark on you. I considered pointing out the small scar by my eyebrow, but thought better of it. A waitress I knew named Lizzie, who wore her black curls pulled onto the top of her head with a rubber band, came to the table and put a coffee and poppy seed muffin down in front of me. Fresh, she said, and walked away. Fluffy watched her retreat with wonder. They know you here? I live close by. And you're handsome, she said. A woman's going to remember a handsome man like you. Maeve says you've got a girl, though, and she doesn't think much of her, in case you didn't know. That's not my business. I'm just glad I didn't wreck your face. The last time I laid eyes on you, you were covered in blood and screaming. Then Jocelyn runs in to take you to the hospital. I thought for sure I'd killed you, all that blood, but you turned out fine. I'm fine. She pressed her lips into an approximation of a smile. Sandy told me you were fine, but I didn't believe her. What else was she going to say? I carried it around with me for years and years. I felt so awful. I didn't stay in touch with any of them, you know. Once I moved to the city, that was it. No looking back. Sometimes you've got to put the past in the past. Sure. Which brings me to your father. She took down the rest of her water. Maeve told me he died. I'm sorry about that. You know, you look an awful lot like him, right? My kids are mutts, all three of them. They don't look like me or my husband, either one of us. Bobby's Italian. Di Camillo. Fiona Di Camillo is a mutt name if ever there was one. Bobby never knew about me and your father. She stopped there, a sudden flush of panic rising up her neck. This was a woman whose biology betrayed her at every turn. Emotion stormed across her face with a flag. Maeve told you that, didn't she, about your father and me? She did. Fluffy exhaled, shook her head. My God, I thought I'd just put my foot in it. Bobby doesn't need to know about that. You probably don't need to know about it either, but there you go. I was just a kid then, and I was stupid. I thought your father was going to marry me. I slept right there on the second floor in the room next to you and your sister, and I thought it was only a matter of me moving across the hall. Well, ha! The waitresses at the Hungarian pastry shop had to turn sideways to get between the tables holding their coffee pots high. Everyone was jostled, and the light poured in across the formica tables and the silverware and the thick white china cups, and I saw none of it. I was back in the kitchen of the Dutch house, and Fluffy was there. That morning, she said, and nodded to make sure I understood which morning we were talking about, your father and I had a fight, and I wasn't thinking clearly. I'm not saying it wasn't my fault, but I'm saying I wasn't myself. A fight about what? I let my eyes wander over to the pastry case, the pies and cakes all twice as tall as pies and cakes were meant to be. About our not getting married. He'd never come right out and said he was going to marry me, but what year was it then, 1950, 51? It never crossed my mind that we weren't getting married. I was right there in his bed, if you'll forgive me for saying so. And he got up to get dressed, and I was feeling so happy about things. And I said I thought we should start making plans. And he said, making plans for what? Oh, I said, feeling the discomfort of familiarity. Fluffy raised her eyebrows, making her green eyes appear all the larger. If it was just that he wasn't going to marry me, well, that would have been bad enough. But the reason... She stopped and took a bite of her Danish with a fork. Then, bite by bite, she proceeded to eat the entire thing. That was it. Fluffy, who had not stopped talking since I walked in the door, shut down like a mechanical horse in need of another nickel. I waited well past the point of prudence for her to pick her story up again. "Are you going to tell me?" She nodded, her tremendous energy having deserted her. "I have a lot to tell you," she said. "All ears." She gave me a stern look, the look of a governess to a smart-mouthed child. "Your father said he couldn't marry me because he was still married to your mother." That was something I never considered. They were still married? I was willing to be immoral. I think I've established that. I was sleeping with a man I wasn't married to. Okay, fine, my mistake. I'll live with it. But I thought your father was divorced. I never would have gone to bed with a married man. You believe that, don't you? I told her I did. Absolutely. What I didn't tell her was that a man who wants to sleep with the pretty young nanny across the hall never has any intention of marrying her. What better lie than to tell her he's still married? My father wasn't much more of a Catholic than I was, but he was too Catholic to be a bigamist, and Andrea was too smart to marry a bigamist, and Lawyer Gooch was too thorough to have overlooked such a detail. I never would have done anything against your mother. I liked your father fine, I did. He was handsome and sad and all those nonsense things girls think are so important at that age. But Elna Conroy was my heart. I never saw myself filling her shoes. No one could have done that. But I meant to take care of you and your sister and your father the way she would have wanted. She was so worried about you before she left. She loved the three of you so much. Before there was a chance to formulate all the questions there were to be asked, I felt a strong hand on my shoulder. "Danny, you've got a day off." Dr. Abel was beaming. "I should be seeing more of you now that your residency is finished, not less. I've been hearing rumors." Fluffy and I were sitting at a foretop. There were two empty places set with silverware and napkins that I hoped he had the sense to overlook. "Dr. Abel," I said, "this is my friend, Fiona." "Maury," Dr. Abel leaned across the table to shake her hand. "Fluffy." Maury Abel smiled and nodded. "Well, I can see you two are busy. Danny, you won't make me have to track you down, will you?" "I won't. Say hello to Mrs. Abel for me." "Mrs. Abel knows who owned those parking lots," he said and laughed. "You may not get an invitation to Thanksgiving this year." "Good," Fluffy said to him. "Then Danny can come and have Thanksgiving with us." When he walked away from the table, Fluffy seemed to understand that our time at the Hungarian pastry shop was not infinite. She decided to get to the point. "You know your mother is here," she said. "I've seen her." Lizzie sailed past, tipping her coffee pot in my direction. I shook my head while Fluffy held up her cup for more. "What?" There was a cold wind coming in the door. "She's dead," I wanted to say. "Surely she's dead by now." "I couldn't tell your sister. I couldn't make her diabetes worse." "Knowing where your mother is doesn't make diabetes worse," I said, trying to apply logic to a conversation where no logic existed. Fluffy shook her head. "It certainly can. You don't remember how sick she was. You were too young. Your mother would come and go and come and go, and when she finally left for good, Maeve nearly died. That's just a fact. After that, your father told her she could never come home again. He wrote her a letter when Maeve was in the hospital. I know that. He told her she'd all but killed the two of you."
"The two of us?"
"Well," she said, "not you. He only threw you in to make her feel worse. If you ask me, he was trying to get her to come back. He just went about it wrong." Had anyone asked me an hour before this meeting how I felt about my mother, I would have sworn I had no feelings on the subject, which made it difficult to understand the enormity of my rage. I held up my hand to stop Fluffy from talking for a second, just to give my brain the chance to catch up. And she raised her hand and touched her palm lightly to mine, as if we were measuring the length of our fingers. Maybe because he was sitting with a student two tables away, a boy around the age I must have been when we first met, I saw myself standing in the door of Maury Abel's office. "No parents?" he asked. "Where is she now?" I was suddenly struck by the possibility that my mother was going to walk in the Hungarian pastry shop and pull up a chair, that this entire reunion was a setup for some horrific surprise. "I don't know where she is now. I saw her more than a year ago, maybe two. I'm bad with time. I'm sure it was in the Bowery, though. I looked out the window of a bus, and there she was, Elna Conroy, just standing there like she was waiting for me. It about stopped my heart." I exhaled, my own heart starting again. "You mean you saw someone who looked like my mother when you were on a bus?" The idea of seeing anyone you knew out the window of a bus seemed far-fetched. But I never took the bus, and when I did, I don't suppose I looked out the window. Fluffy rolled her eyes. "Jesus, I'm not an idiot, Danny. I got off the bus. I went back and found her." "And it was her? Elna Conroy, who had run off to India in the night, leaving her husband and two sleeping children, was in the Bowery? She was just the same, I swear it. Her hair's gone gray, and she wears it in a braid now, the way Maeve used to. They both have that ridiculous hair." "Did she remember you?" "I haven't changed that much," Fluffy said. I was the one who had changed. Fluffy dumped her coffee into her water glass and let the ice melt. "The first thing she asked about was you and Maeve. And since I didn't know, there was nothing I could tell her. I didn't even know where you lived. The shame of it all came back on me like the whole thing had happened yesterday. I'll never get over it. To think I'd been fired, to think why I'd been fired, and that I hadn't stayed to look after you the way I'd promised her I would." Her grief hung between us. We were her children. It seems like she should have stayed and looked after us herself. "She's a wonderful woman, Danny. She had a terrible time of it." "A terrible time of it, living in the Dutch house." Fluffy looked down at her empty plate. "This wasn't her fault. Even if she'd hit me, even if she'd been thrown out because of it, there was very little forgiveness in my heart, and what I had, I gave to Fluffy." "There's no way for you to understand," she said. "She couldn't live like that. She's doing her penance down there serving soup. She's trying to make up for what she's done." "Who is she making it up to? To me? To Maeve?" Fluffy considered this. "To God, I guess. There's no other reason she'd have been in the Bowery." I, who had bought property in Harlem and Washington Heights, would not have touched the Bowery with a stick. "When did she leave India?" Fluffy tore open two sugar packets, added them to her iced coffee, and stirred. I wanted to tell her the whole thing would have gone better if she'd put the sugar in the coffee while the coffee was still hot. In fact, I wanted to tell her it would have been infinitely preferable to get together in order to discuss how sugar dissolves. "A long time ago. She said it had been years and years. She said the people had been very kind to her. Can you imagine? She would have been happy to stay there, but she had to go where she was needed."
"Which wasn't Elkins Park."
"She gave up everything. That's what you have to understand. She gave up you and your sister and your father and that house so she could help the poor. She lived in India and God only knows how many other horrible places. She was down there on the Bowery. The whole place stinks, you know. It's foul down there, the trash and the people, and Your mother's serving soup to the junkies and the drunks. If that's not being sorry, I don't know what is.
I shook my head. That's being delusional, not sorry.
I wish I could have talked to her more, Fluffy said, her feelings clearly hurt. But I was going to be late for my job. I'm a baby nurse now. I get in and get out before I get too attached. And to tell you the truth, the bums were crawling all over the place, and I didn't feel so comfortable standing there on the street. Just as soon as I had that thought, she told me she was going to walk me to the bus stop. She put my arm in hers like we were two old friends. She told me she'd be working down there for a while, and that I could come back and serve if I wanted to, or just come back and visit. I kept thinking I'd go see her again on my day off, but Bobby wasn't having it. He said I had no business making lunch for a bunch of guys on the needle. I sat back in my chair trying to take it in. I was glad that Maeve didn't come to the city. I didn't want her looking out a bus window and seeing our mother on the street. Do you know where she is now? She shook her head. I should have tried to find you sooner so I could have told you. It wouldn't have been hard. I feel bad about that. I motioned to Lizzie for the check. If my mother had wanted to see us, she would have found us herself, like you said. It wouldn't have been hard. Fluffy was twisting the paper napkin in her fingers. Believe me, I know what a bad time everyone went through. I was there. But your mother has a higher calling than we do, that's all. I put my money on the table. Then I hope she enjoys it. When I looked at my watch, I realized I was already late. I'd scheduled a meeting with a contractor as a means of ensuring my time with Fluffy would be limited. She walked with me two blocks before it became clear she was going in the wrong direction. She took my hand. We'll do this again, won't we? She said. Maeve has my number. I'd like to see you both. I want you to meet my kids. They're great kids, like you and your sister. Maeve was right. Not only was it remarkable to see Fluffy again, but I felt a complete absence of anger towards her. She had been in an impossible situation. No one would say that what had happened had been her fault.
Would you leave them?
Who?
Your great kids, I said. Would you walk away and leave them now? And never let them know that you were still alive? Would you have left them before they were old enough to remember you? Left them for Bobby to raise on his own?
I could see the blow travel through her, and she took a step away from me. No, she said.
Then you're the good person, I said. Not my mother.
Oh, Danny, she said, and her voice caught in her throat. She hugged me goodbye. When she walked away, she turned back to look at me so many times she appeared to be going up the sidewalk in a loose series of concentric circles. The fact of the matter was, I had seen my mother too, though I hadn't known it at the time. As I walked to 116th Street after leaving Fluffy, I had no doubt that it had happened. It had been in the emergency room at Albert Einstein around midnight, maybe 2 years before, maybe three. All the chairs in the waiting room were full. Parents held half-grown children in their laps, paced with children in their arms. People were propped up against the walls, bleeding and moaning, vomiting into their laps. A standard Saturday night in the Gun and Knife Club. I had just scoped a young woman with a crushed airway, a steering wheel, a boyfriend. And once I got the endoscope down past her nasal passages, both of her vocal cords were collapsed. Blood and spit were bubbling in every direction, and it took forever to get an endotracheal tube in place. When I finished the procedure, I went to the waiting room to look for whoever had brought her in. As I called the name on the chart, a woman behind me tapped my shoulder, saying, "Doctor." Everyone did that, the sick and those advocating for the sick. They chanted and begged, "Doctor, nurse, doctor, nurse." The emergency room at Albert Einstein was a cyclone of human need, and the trick was to keep focused on the thing you'd come to do, ignoring the rest. But when I turned around, the woman looked at me with such, what, surprise? Fear? I remember raising my hand to my face to see if there was blood on it. That had happened before.
She was tall and dismally thin, and in my mind, I assigned her to the ash heap of late-stage lung cancer or tuberculosis. None of this distinguished her in that particular crowd. The only reason she'd stuck with me at all was because she called me Cyril. I would have asked her how she knew my father, but then a man was there saying it was his girlfriend I had just scoped. I was taking him into the hallway, wondering if he, in fact, had strangled her. I'd been in the waiting room for less than a minute, and by the time I had the chance to wonder about the woman with the gray braid who called me by my father's name, she was long gone and I was no longer interested. I didn't wonder if she'd been a tenant in one of the Conroy buildings, or if she was someone he had known in Brooklyn. I certainly never thought about my mother. Like everyone else who worked in the ER, I pressed ahead with what was in front of me, and I made it through the night. To grow up with a mother who had run off to India, never to be heard from again, that was one thing. There was closure in that, its own kind of death. But to find out she was 15 stops away on the number one train to Canal and had failed to be in touch was barbaric. Whatever romantic notions I might have harbored, whatever excuses or allowances my heart had ever made on her behalf, blew out like a match. The contractor was waiting for me in the lobby when I got back, and we talked about the window frames that were pulling away from the brick in the front of the building. He was still there taking measurements an hour later when Celeste came home from school. She was so buoyant, so bright, her yellow hair tangled from the wind that had kicked up. She was telling me about the children in her class and how they had all cut leaves from construction paper and printed their names on the leaves so she could make a tree on her classroom door. And as I listened, less to what she was saying and more to the pleasing sound of her voice, I knew that Celeste would always be there. She had proven her commitment to me time and again. If men were fated to marry their mothers, well, here was my chance to buck the trend. "Ah," she said, dropping her book bags on the floor and reaching up to kiss me. "I'm talking too much. I'm like the kids. I get all wound up. Tell me about the grown-up world. Tell me about your day." But I didn't tell her anything, not about the pastry shop or Fluffy or my mother. I told her instead that I'd been thinking, and I thought it was time we got married. Chapter 13. I wished my part of the work hadn't all fallen to Maeve, who drove to Rydal to have lunch with Celeste and her mother and talk about napkin colors and the merits of having hard liquor at the reception versus only serving beer and wine with champagne for the toast. "Frozen vegetables," Maeve said to me later. I wanted to tell her that would be my contribution. I'll flood their backyard with little green peas, which would spare me having to sit through another conversation about whether the lawn will still be green enough in July. "I'm sorry," I said. "You shouldn't have to deal with that." Maeve rolled her eyes. "Well, it isn't like you're going to do it. Either I get involved or we have no representation at the wedding." "I'm planning on representing us at the wedding." "You don't understand. I'm not even married, and I understand." Celeste said it was hard for Maeve to watch me get married before she did. Celeste said that at 37 there was pretty much no chance of Maeve finding someone, and so the wedding plans were no doubt filling her with something less than joy. But that wasn't it. In the first place, Maeve would never begrudge me any happiness, and in the second place, I had never once heard her mention even a passing interest in marriage. Maeve didn't care about the wedding. Her issue was with the bride. I tried to explain to my sister that I had dated plenty of women and Celeste really was the best choice. I hadn't rushed into anything either. We'd been going together off and on since college. "You're picking the woman you like the best from a group of women you don't like," Maeve said. "Your control group is fundamentally flawed." But I had picked the woman who had committed herself to smoothing my path and supporting my life. The problem was that Maeve thought she was taking care of that herself. As for Maeve's love life, or lack thereof, I knew nothing, but I will say this. I'd watched her test her blood sugar and inject herself with insulin all my life, but she didn't do it around other people, not unless it was a full-on emergency. When I was in medical school and then later in my residency, I tried to talk to her about her management, but she would have no part of it. "I have an endocrinologist," she'd say, "and I have no interest in being your endocrinologist. I'm just saying, as your brother, that I'm interested in your health." Very kind. Now cut it out. Maeve and I had endless reasons to be suspicious of marriage. The history of our youth would be enough to make anyone bet against it. But if I had to guess, I wouldn't have put the blame on Andrea or either of our parents. If I'd had to guess where Maeve was concerned, I would have said she could never have allowed anyone else in the room when she stabbed a needle in her stomach. "Tell me again what my not being married has to do with you marrying Celeste." "Nothing. I just want to make sure you're okay." "Trust me," she said, "I don't want to marry Celeste. She's all yours." Had it not been for Maeve, every aspect of the wedding, all the costs and the decisions, would have fallen to the Norcross family. Maeve believed we, Conroy, should not begin the alliance of families in such a state of inequality. After all, when you added in uncles and aunts and all the various degrees of cousins, both by marriage and blood, there were more Norcrosses than there were stars in the sky, and there were only the two of us Conroys. I understood that someone from our side needed to show up, and since our side consisted of Maeve and me, it fell to Maeve. I was meeting with electricians in those days and learning the surprisingly difficult skill of repairing drywall. I was too busy to participate in the details, and so I sent my sister, who lived a scant 15 minutes from Celeste's parents, as my emissary. In this spirit of division of labor, Maeve volunteered to write our engagement announcement for the paper. "Mary Celeste Norcross, daughter of William and Julie Norcross, will marry Daniel James Conroy, son of Elna Conroy and the late Cyril Conroy, on Saturday, the 23rd of July." But Celeste didn't like the word late. She thought it was a downer in light of the happy occasion. "And your mother," Maeve said to me over the phone, doing an uncanny imitation of Celeste's voice, "do you seriously want your mother's name in the engagement announcement?" "Ah," I said. "I told her you do, in fact, have a mother, a missing mother, and a dead father. That's what we've got." Then she asked if we could just leave them out altogether, seeing as how they're not here. It's not as if we'd be hurting their feelings. Well, didn't strike me as an outrageous proposal. "We'd be hurting my feelings," Maeve said. "You're not a mushroom who popped up after a rain. You have parents." Julie Norcross, my ever-rational future mother-in-law, broke the tie in Maeve's favor. "That's the way it's done," she said to her daughter. The proposed compromise to which Maeve finally capitulated after much grousing was that our parents' names would not appear on the wedding invitation. And through all of this, I never told my sister that our mother was out there, circling. I put it off not because I thought it would harm Maeve's health, but because we were better off without her. That was what Fluffy's news had made me realize. After so many years of chaos and exile, our lives had finally settled. Now that it was no longer my job to draw down the trust, we rarely spoke of Andrea at all. We didn't think about her. I wasn't practicing medicine. I owned 3 buildings. I was getting married. May, for whatever reasons of her own, continued on at Otterson's without complaint. She seemed happier than I had ever known her to be, even if she didn't want me to marry Celeste. After years of living in response to the past, we had somehow become miraculously unstuck, moving forward in time just like everyone else. To tell Maeve our mother was out there, to tell her I wasn't sure if our parents had ever divorced, meant reigniting the fire I'd spent my life stamping out. Why should we go looking for her? She'd never come looking for us. I don't mean that Maeve didn't deserve to know or that I would never tell her. I just didn't think this was the time. Celeste and I were married on a sweltering day in late July at St. Hilary's in Rydal. A fall wedding would have been more comfortable, but Celeste said she wanted to have everything settled and done before school started in September. Maeve said Celeste didn't want to give me the time to back out. The Norcrosses rented a tent for the reception, and Celeste and Maeve put aside their considerable differences for the occasion. Maury Abel stood up as my best man. He found my defection from science to be hilarious. "I wish I'd have my professional career on you," he said, his arm around my shoulder, like any proud father. Years later, I would buy a building on Riverside Drive, a pre-war jewel box with an Art Deco lobby and green glass inlays in the elevator doors. I gave the Abels half the top floor and a key to the roof for what they would have paid for an efficiency. They would stay there for the rest of their lives. Celeste flung her diaphragm into the Atlantic on our honeymoon. In the early morning hours, we watched it catch a gentle wave and bob away from the coast of Maine. "That's a little disgusting," I said. "People will think it's a jellyfish." She snapped shut the empty pink case and dropped it in her purse. We had tried to get in the water the day before, but even in late July we found it impossible to go past our knees, so we went back to the hotel, and Celeste put her swimsuit on so that I could take it off again. She thought we had very nearly waited too long as it was. At 29, she wasn't going to put nature off another cycle. Our daughter was born 9 months later. Over protests, I named the baby for my sister, and as a compromise, we called her May. Everything about May was easy. I told Celeste we could throw a tarp over the bed, and I could deliver her myself if she felt like staying home, but she didn't. We took a taxi to Columbia Presbyterian in the middle of the night, and 6 hours later, our daughter was delivered by one of my former classmates. Celeste's mother came up for a week, and Maeve came for a day. Maeve and Julie Norcross had grown fond of each other through the wedding preparations, and Maeve had found that things between her and Celeste were better when Celeste's mother was around. She planned her brief visits accordingly. Celeste quit her teaching job at the Columbia School, and 5 months later, she was pregnant again. She was good at having babies, she'd like to say. She was going to play to her strength. But babies are largely a matter of luck, and there was no guarantee that what was easy once would be easy twice. 25 weeks into the second pregnancy, Celeste started to have contractions and was sent to bed to stay. She was told her cervix was lazy, unable to hold the baby in place against the tireless pull of gravity. She took it to be a personal indictment. "No one said it was lazy last year," she said. They would have kept her in the hospital if it hadn't been for the fact that I was considered to be enough of a doctor to administer the medications and watch her blood pressure. What I couldn't manage, along with work and Celeste, was taking care of May. "We're going to need to hire someone," I said. Celeste had made it clear she didn't want her mother moving to New York, and the idea of having Maeve come in to help wasn't up for discussion. "I just wish there was someone we knew," Celeste said. And she was frustrated and scared and angry at herself for not being able to take care of things the way she always had. "I don't want a stranger taking care of May." "I could try Fluffy," I said, though the suggestion was half-hearted. To call in Fluffy, like some other things, seemed to be taking a big step backwards. I was holding May on one hip, and she squirmed and reached her chubby hands for her mother. "What's Fluffy?" "Who's Fluffy?" "What are you talking about? I never told you about Fluffy." Celeste sighed and straightened her blanket. "I guess not. No one forgets a Fluffy." In the earliest days of our relationship, Celeste had asked about the small scar beside my eye, and I told her I'd caught a backhand playing doubles at Choate. I wasn't about to tell the pretty girl in my bed that my Irish nanny had hit me with a spoon. If I'd never even mentioned Fluffy, then Celeste didn't know about my father's affair, either. It would have been difficult to put forward a candidate who'd slept with the employer and hit the child, but in truth, I'd forgiven her for all of it. Like Maeve said, there was no holding a grudge against anyone from that time in our lives. "She was our nanny. She lives in the Bronx now," I said. "I thought Sandy and Jocelyn were your nannies." Sandy was the housekeeper. Jocelyn was the cook. Fluffy was the nanny. Celeste closed her eyes and nodded peaceably. "I have trouble keeping the household staff straight." "Should I call her?" May, who had an uncanny ability to concentrate her weight, had turned into a 50-pound sack of potatoes in my arms. I put her down beside her mother. "Why not try? You turned out nice enough." Celeste reached for our daughter, whom she could lie beside but not pick up. "At least it's a place to start." And so it came to pass that nearly 30 years after we had last lived under the same roof, Fluffy came to 116th Street to care for our daughter. Celeste could not have been more pleased with the arrangement. The fleas were everywhere, I heard Fluffy saying to my wife the day after we'd hired her. I just come in the front door and I stood in the tiny entry hall to listen. I wasn't eavesdropping. The apartment was too small for that. They knew perfectly well I was there. The first time I went over to meet the Conroys, they were standing there scratching. I was dying to make a good impression, you know. I'd been the caretaker for the house when it was empty, and I was hoping they'd keep me on. So I put on my best dress and went over to introduce myself, and there they were with their piles of boxes. I could see the fleas on Maeve's little legs. They went after her like a sugar loaf. Wait, Celeste said. Didn't you live in the house? I lived in the garage. There was an apartment on the top where my parents had lived when they worked for the Van Hoobakes. Of course, I stayed in the house when I was taking care of the old lady. I never left her alone. But after she died, well, the whole business made me sad, so I went back to the garage. I'd grown up there. I'd been one of the house girls. Then I was the only servant in the entire place. Then I was the nursemaid. Then I was the caretaker. Then I was the Conroy's nanny, first for Maeve, then Danny. Then you were the mistress, I thought, putting down the mail. I was good at all my jobs except being the caretaker. I was awful at that. But it's completely different work, Celeste said, taking care of people or taking care of an empty house. I was afraid of the house. I kept thinking the Van Hoobakes were still in there, that they were ghosts. I just couldn't imagine the place without them, even if they were dead. I could barely make myself dart in there once a week and look around at the height of day, so I didn't know the raccoons had eaten their way into the ballroom with all those fleas. They must have just hatched, because there were no fleas when the banker came, and there were no fleas when the Conroys came to see the house. But by the time they moved in, the fleas were everywhere. You could see them hopping around in the rugs on the walls. I wouldn't have blamed them if they'd put me out on the spot. The fleas weren't your fault, Celeste said. But they were, if you think about it. I was asleep at my post. What do you think? Should I put this girl down and make you some lunch? Danny, Celeste called. Do you want lunch? I came into the bedroom. Celeste was stretched out on our bed, and Fluffy was sitting in a chair with May asleep in her arms. Celeste looked up at me and smiled. Fluffy's been telling me about the fleas. His mother kept me on, Fluffy said, smiling like it was something I had done myself. She wasn't much older than I was, but I acted like she was my mother. I was so lonely, and she was so kind. As miserable as Elna was, she always made me feel like she was happy I was there. She was miserable because of the fleas? Because of the house. Poor Elna hated that house. I could stand some lunch, I said. Why poor Elna? Celeste asked. Ever since I told her the story of my life, my wife had held my mother in particularly low regard. She believed there could be no reason to leave two children. Fluffy looked down at my daughter asleep on her chest. She was too good to live in a place like that. Celeste looked up at me, confused. I thought you said it was a nice place. I'll go get sandwiches, I said, turning away. I wanted to tell Fluffy to stop it. But why? She was telling these stories to Celeste, the only person in the world who wanted to hear them. Fluffy told Celeste the stories of the Dutch house, like Scheherazade trying to win another night. And Celeste, whose mind was finally off her troubles, wouldn't have let her go for anything in the world. Kevin came early and spent his first 6 weeks of life in an incubator box staring at us through the clear plastic wall with his frog eyes while Fluffy stayed home with May. Everything's fine, Fluffy would say to me, kissing my daughter on the head, a series of rapid-fire pecks. We're all where we need to be. Maeve came up on the train while Celeste was in the hospital, as much to spend days with Fluffy as with her namesake. Maeve and Fluffy had an insatiable appetite for the past when they were together. They went through the Dutch house room by room. Do you remember that stove? One of them would say. How you had to light the burners with a match? I always thought it was going to blow us all the kingdom come. It took so long for the fire to catch. Do you remember those pink silk sheets in the bedroom on the third floor? I've never seen sheets like that again in my life. I bet they're still perfect. No one ever slept in that bed.
Do you remember when the two of us went swimming in the pool and Jocelyn said it wasn't good to have to see the nanny splashing around like a seal in the middle of the workday? Then they would laugh and laugh until May laughed with them. I had bought Celeste a brownstone just north of the Museum of Natural History right after May was born and worked on it myself on the weekends, a big four-story beyond our means, the kind of house we could stay in for the rest of our lives. The neighborhood was imperfect, but it was better than the one we were in. The winds of gentrification were starting to shift towards the Upper West Side, and I wanted to get ahead of them. To make a new life, we would have to travel all of 25 blocks. I would pay Sandy and Jocelyn to come up on the weekend and, along with Fluffy, get our things boxed and unboxed. "We're moving now?" Celeste said, while we sat in the waiting room of the NICU. Visiting hours started at 9. "There's never a good time to move," I said. "This way Kevin can come home to his new house." The new house had 4 bedrooms, though we kept Kevin and May together in one when they were small. "Less running around to do," Fluffy said. "There are too many damn stairs in this place." Celeste agreed and had me squeeze a single bed into the crowded nursery. She'd had an emergency cesarean in the end, and she said she'd just as soon not have to go too far when one of the children cried. One night, after getting Celeste a sweater from our bedroom on the top floor, then turning over a load of laundry on the ground floor, then changing May's diapers and getting her another outfit on the third floor and taking the soiled clothes back down to the wash, Fluffy fell onto the couch next to Celeste, her cheeks flaming, chest heaving. "Are you okay?" Celeste asked, Kevin in her arms. May took a few uneven steps in the direction of the fireplace where I had just laid a fire. "May," I said. Fluffy pulled in a deep breath, then held out her hands, at which point May turned around and toddled straight to her. "Too many damn stairs," Celeste said. Fluffy nodded, and in another minute, she found her breath. "It makes me think of poor old Mrs. Van Hoobake when she was dying. I hated all those stairs." "Did she fall?" I asked, because I did not know one single thing about the Van Hoobakes other than they'd manufactured cigarettes and were dead. "Well, she didn't fall down the stairs, if that's what you mean. She fell in the garden, out cutting peonies. She fell over in the nice, soft grass and broke her hip." "When?" "When?" Fluffy repeated, temporarily stumped by the question. "We were well into the war, I know that. All the boys were dead by then. Mr. Van Hoobake was dead. Me and the missus were alone in the house." Fluffy tried to call Celeste missus when she first came to work for us, but Celeste would have none of it. "How did the boys die?" Celeste pulled the blanket up around Kevin's neck. Even with the fire going, the room was cold. I needed to work on the windows. "Are you counting all of them? Linus had leukemia. He went young, couldn't have been 12. The older boys, Peter and Martin, they both died in France. They said if the U.S. wouldn't take them, they'd go back to Holland to fight. We got word that one of them was gone, and it wasn't a month later we had the news about the other. They were beautiful men, like princes from a picture book. I could never decide which one I was more in love with." "And Mr. Van Hoobake?" I sat down in the big chair near the fireplace. The clock ticked out the minutes of the night. I hadn't meant to stay with him, and yet I stayed. The living room wrapped around us in the flickering light. I could hear the cars racing up and down Broadway a block away. I could hear the rain. "Emphysema. That's why I never did smoke. Old Mr. Van Hoobake smoked enough for every member of the family. It's a terrible death," Fluffy said, looking at me. Celeste pulled her feet up beneath her. "So Mrs. Van Hoobake?" She wanted a story. May babbled for a minute in Fluffy's lap, and then settled as if to listen. "I called the ambulance, and they came and picked her up out of the garden and carted her off. I drove over behind them in the last car we had. My father had been the chauffeur, you know, so I knew how to drive. I asked them at the hospital if I could sleep in the old lady's room, keep an eye on her, and the nurse told me no. She said they were going to have to put a pin in her hip and that she'd need to rest.
My parents had found a job in Virginia. All the other servants had been let go through the Depression. I was the only one left in the house back then. I was more than 20, and I'd never spent the night alone in my life. Fluffy shook her head at the thought. I was petrified. I kept thinking I could hear people talking. Then at some point after it got dark, I realized that I was the one who was there to keep the missus safe, not the other way around. Did I think this tiny old woman had been protecting me? May yawned and flopped her head under the shelf of Fluffy's breasts, looking up at her one last time to confirm that she was really there before letting her eyes drift closed. Did she die in the hospital? I asked. I didn't think the outcome for pinning hips would have been very good in the 40s. Oh, no, she came through fine. I went to see her every day, and at the end of 2 weeks, the ambulance man brought her back. This was what my story was about in the first place, why I hated stairs. They carried her up the stairs on a stretcher and laid her out in her bed, and I got her pillows all fixed. She was so happy to be home. She thanked the men. She said she was sorry to be so heavy, when the fact was she weighed about as much as a hen. She slept in the big front bedroom where your parents slept. After the men had gone, I asked her if she wanted tea, and she said yes, so I ran downstairs to fix it, and from there on out, it never stopped. There was one thing, and one more thing. I was up and down those stairs every 5 minutes, and that was fine. I was young, but after about a week or so, I realized what a mistake I'd made. I should have set her up downstairs, right there in the foyer, where she would have had the view. Downstairs, she could have looked at the grass and the trees and the birds, everything that was still hers. Where she was upstairs, all she had to look at was the fireplace. She couldn't see anything out the window from where she was but the sky. She never complained, but it made me so sad for her. I knew she wasn't going to get better. There wasn't any reason for her to. She was such a sweet old bird. Every time I needed to go to the store or get her medicine, I'd have to give her an extra pill and knock her out. Otherwise, she'd get confused if I wasn't right there, and she'd try to get out of bed by herself. She couldn't remember that her hip was broken. That was a problem. She was always trying to get up. I'd tell her to hold still, and then I'd fly down the stairs to get what she needed and come right back up, and half the time she'd be crawling out, 1 foot touching the floor. So then I started pulling her over to the middle of the bed and making a wall of pillows around her, like you'd do with a baby, and then I'd go down the stairs twice as fast. I could have run a marathon, but I don't think they had marathons back then. She looked down at May and swept her hand over the baby's fine black hair. There wasn't a soft spot on me. There were times early on when Celeste would have something to say about Maeve, but Fluffy wouldn't hear it. I love my children, she'd said, and Maeve was my first. I saved her life, you know. When she came down with the diabetes, I was the one who took her to the hospital. Imagine little May growing up and someone wanting me to listen to bad things about her. She gave May a few bounces on her hip and made her laugh. Isn't gonna happen, she said to the baby. Celeste quickly fell in line. The central adult relationship in her life was with Fluffy now, and she lived in terror of the day when the children would be deemed old enough for her to manage on her own. Not only was it necessary to have an extra set of hands for two children so close in age, but Fluffy knew what to do for an earache, a rash, boredom. She knew better than I did when a call to the pediatrician was in order. Fluffy was a genius as far as babies were concerned, but she had a keen sense for mothers as well. She took care of Celeste as much as she did of Kevin and May, praising her for every good decision, telling her when to rest, teaching her how to make stew, and when it rained or was dark or was simply too cold to go out, there was an endless trove of Van Hoobake stories to open again. Celeste had fallen in love with those, too. The garage was way over to the side of the house, but if I stood on the toilet seat and opened the window, I could see the guests coming in for the parties. Nothing exists like the parties they had back then, nothing in the world. All the windows would be open, and the guests would walk in through the windows from the terrace. When the weather was cold, they danced upstairs in the ballroom, but when it was nice outside, there were workmen who would come out during the day and put down a dance floor made out of pieces of polished wood that all snapped together. That way the guests could dance on the lawn. There was a little orchestra, and everyone was laughing and laughing. My mother used to say the silkiest sound on earth was a rich woman's laugh. She would work in the kitchen all day to get things ready, and then she served until 2 or 3 in the morning. Then she cleaned it all up. There were plenty of people there to help, but it was my mother's kitchen. My father would take all the cars away and bring them back for the guests when they were ready to leave. I'd be fast asleep on the couch when they came in, no matter how hard I tried to stay awake. Well, I was just a tiny thing, and my mother would wake me up and give me a glass of flat champagne, whatever little bit was left in the bottle. She'd wake me up and say, "Fiona, look what I brought you." And I'd drink it up and go right back to sleep. I couldn't have been more than 5. That champagne was the most wonderful thing in the world. "How do you think my father got the money to buy the house?" I asked Fluffy late one night, in an almost sacred moment of silence, both of the children asleep in their cribs. Celeste asleep on the little bed in the nursery where she had lain down just for a minute and then was lost. Fluffy and I were standing side by side. She was washing the dishes while I dried. "It was the boy in the hospital when your father was in France." I turned to her, a dinner plate in my hands. "You know this?" I wasn't even sure what had made me ask her, but I had never considered that she might know the answer. Fluffy nodded. "He fell out of the plane and broke his shoulder. I guess he was in that hospital forever. And there were lots of people coming and going all the time. For a few days, there was a boy on the cot next to his who had been shot in the chest. I try not to think too much about that. The boy wasn't awake very often, but when he was, he talked to your father. This boy said if he had money, he'd buy up land in Horsham. No doubt about it, he said. And so your father asked him why. I imagine it must have been nice to have someone to talk to. The boy told him that what with the war and all, he wasn't at liberty to say, but that Cyril should remember those two words, Horsham, Pennsylvania. Your father remembered. I took another plate from her soapy fingers and a glass. The kitchen was at the back of the house, and there was a window over the sink. Fluffy always said there was no greater luxury for a woman than to have a window over the sink. My father told you this? Your father? Oh, Lord, no, your father wouldn't have told me the time if I'd asked him. Your mother told me. We were thick as thieves, your mother and I. You have to remember, when they showed up at the Dutch house that first day, she believed they were poor people. She made him tell her how he got the money. She made him. She was sure he'd done something illegal. Nobody had money like that back then. I thought of myself as an undergraduate, finding that first building in foreclosure, wondering how my father had struck it rich. What happened? Well, the poor boy died, of course, leaving your father plenty of time to think about him. He stayed in that cot for another 3 months before there was a spot on a transport ship to send him home. After that, he was put on a desk job at the shipyard in Philadelphia. He had never been to Philadelphia a day in his life. After he and your mother were settled, he got out a map, and what does he see but Horsham, not an hour away? He decided to go out there, I guess, to be respectful to the boy. I have no idea how your father got there, but the place was nothing but farmland. He made some inquiries just to see if anything was for sale, and he found a man who had 10 acres he'd part with, dirt cheap. That's where the expression came from, you know. Cheap dirt was dirt cheap. But where did he get the money to buy the land? Things can be cheap, but if you didn't have money, it hardly mattered. I knew that from experience. He'd saved up from the TVA. He'd worked on the dams for 3 years before the war. They paid him next to nothing, but your father was a man who hadn't parted with his first nickel. Now, mind you, your mother didn't know about any of this. They were married then. She didn't know about the savings or the boy or Horsham, none of it. 6 months later, the Navy was calling him up, saying that's just where they meant to build a base. I'll be damned. Fluffy nodded, her cheeks red, her hands red in the water. And it would have been a good story if that was all there was to it, but he took the money from the sale and put it down on a big industrial building on the river, And when he sold that, he started buying up tracts of land, and all that time your mother was soaking pinto beans for supper, and he was working for the Navy, ordering supplies, and they were living on the base with your sister. Then one day he says, "Hey, Elna, I borrowed a car. I've got a big surprise to show you." It really was a wonder she didn't kill him. As we stood there, shoulder to shoulder, the dishes done, and the most frustrating mystery of my life resolved, I remembered that this was the woman who had hit me once when I was a child. She had slept with my father and wanted to marry him. I thought of what a better life it would have been had Fluffy gotten her way. Chapter 14. I sold the building we lived in when we were first married for a good price, and I sold those first two brownstones, and with a profit I bought a mixed-use building on Broadway, 6 blocks from where we lived. It had 30 rental units and an Italian restaurant downstairs. I could have been in that building every waking hour, every day of the year, and still not made all the necessary repairs. Uncontrollable steam heat, illegal garbage disposals. One tenant, whose daughter flushed an orange down the toilet to see if it would go, and another who left her door open so her cat could shit in the hall. And the terrier 2 doors down, who would always find the shit and gobble it up and vomit on the floor. With every crisis, I learned how to fix something else, and I learned how to soothe the people whose problems were not mine to solve. I made money. I hired a super and started a management company. The surest way to know if a building was worth buying was to manage it first, or to manage a building on a block where another building went up for sale. Pretty much everything in New York was for sale in those days, if you knew who to ask. I knew the councilman, the cops. I went in and out of basements. Maeve kept my books and did the taxes for the corporation, as well as our personal taxes. It drove Celeste to distraction. "Your sister has no right to have her nose in every corner of our lives," she said. "Sure she does, if I'm the one asking her to do it." Celeste had a habit of overthinking things now that she was home with the kids by herself. Fluffy was a baby nurse again, working for friends of ours 10 blocks south who had adopted twins. She had stayed with us years past her original promise, and she still came over once a week to see us, to make soup, to waltz Kevin around the kitchen in her arms. Celeste alone did the laundry now and arranged for playdates at the park and read The Carrot Seed a million times in a voice of animated engagement. "A little boy planted a carrot seed. His mother said, 'I'm afraid it won't come up.'" She gave her best effort to everything, but still her big, wandering brain was underutilized and would often turn itself against my sister. "You can't have someone in your family do the books. You need to find a professional." "Maeve is a professional. What do you think she does at Otterson's?" Both kids were sleeping, and even though a fire truck could come wailing down Broadway and not disturb their dreams, the sound of their parents arguing could pull them straight up from a coma. "Jesus, Danny, she ships vegetables. We have a real business. There's money at stake." As for my business, Celeste had no idea what was at stake. She knew nothing about the strength of our holdings or the size of our debt. She didn't ask. Had she understood the outrageous financial risk I'd put us in, she wouldn't have slept another night. All she could be sure of was that she didn't want Maeve close, even though in many ways Maeve, with her understanding of tax codes and mortgages, was the one who steered the ship. "Okay, first, Otterson's is a real business." Maeve had told me the profits, though she probably shouldn't have. Celeste held up her hands. "Please don't lecture me about lima beans. Second, look at me, I'm serious. Second, Maeve is completely ethical, which is more than you could say about some accountants who deal with New York real estate. She has nothing but our best interest at heart." "Your best interest," she said in a flat whisper. "She could care less about mine." "It's in your best interest for our business to succeed. Why don't you just invite her to live with us? Wouldn't she like that? She could sleep in our bedroom. We have no secrets." "Your father cleans our teeth." Celeste shook her head. "Not the same. Your teeth, my teeth, the kids' teeth. And you know what? I like it. I'm grateful to your father. He does a good job, so I go to Rydell for a filling. I trust him. I guess that proves what we've both long suspected, which is what? You're a better person than I am. Then Celeste left the bedroom to go and make sure the children hadn't heard the things we'd said. Everything Celeste didn't like about me was Maeve's fault, because being mad at your husband's sister was infinitely easier than being mad at your husband. She might have packed her original disappointments away in a box, but she carried the box with her wherever she went. It would never be completely forgotten that I hadn't married her when she graduated from Thomas More and had been the cause of her return to Rydell, a failure. Nor was it lost on her that the deeper I got into real estate, the happier I became. Celeste had misjudged me. She had planned on giving me the freedom to realize the error of my ways, but medicine never crossed my mind unless I was having lunch with Maury Abel or ran into one of my classmates who applied pressure to gunshot wounds in some emergency room for a living. When May was old enough to ask for a Monopoly set for Christmas, I sat beside the tree and we played. I couldn't imagine my father playing a board game, but this one was genius. The houses and hotels, the deeds and the rent, the windfalls and taxes. Monopoly was the world. May always chose the Scotty dog. Kevin wasn't quite old enough to stick with a game in those days, but he ran the sports car along the edge of the board and made pyramids out of the tiny green houses. Every time I rolled the dice and moved a little iron forward, I thought how lucky I was. City, job, family, house. I wasn't spending my days in a box-like room telling somebody's father he had pancreatic cancer, telling somebody's mother I felt a lump in her breast, telling the parents we had done everything we knew how to do. Which didn't mean my being a doctor never came up. There were plenty of times as the children grew that what I'd learned all those years before was hauled into service. For example, the time we drove the station wagon to Brighton Beach with the Gilbert family, friends we'd made through the kids because that's how people make friends at a certain time in life. And Andy, the Gilbert boy, put a nail through his foot. The nail was in a board. The board was half buried in the sand. I didn't see it happen. The boys were coming out of the water, chasing each other. I was down the beach with Andy's father, a wiry public defender named Chuck, and the two girls, one of them his and one of them mine. The girls were standing in the low waves with their buckets looking for bits of sea glass, when over the sound of the ocean and the wind and all the other kids horsing around and yelling, we heard Andy Gilbert's scream. Celeste and the boy's mother were much closer in, lying on their towels, talking, keeping an eye out for the boys while they swam. We all ran towards Andy at once, fathers, mothers, sisters. He must have been around 9. He was Kevin's friend, and Kevin was 9 that summer. The boy's mother, a beautiful woman with straight brown hair and a red two-piece, I'm sorry to say, I remember that fact while forgetting her name, was reaching down for her son's foot without any idea of what she was going to do about it when Celeste put a hand on her shoulder and said, no, let Danny. The woman, the other mother, looked at my wife and then at me, no doubt wondering what I knew about taking nails out of people's feet. We had just reached them when our son Kevin said to his screaming, crucified friend, it's okay, my dad's sort of a doctor. And in that second, when the Gilberts were still stunned by confusion and fear, I put a foot on either side of Andy's foot to hold the board in place, got the tips of my fingers between the soft beat of his instep and the board, and lifted up very fast. He screamed. Of course he screamed. But there wasn't too much blood, so at least he hadn't sliced an artery. I picked him up, howling and shivering in the heat, slick from the ocean, and started walking to the car in the blinding afternoon sun while the rest of the group scrambled to pick up our day at the beach. Chuck Gilbert came behind me, picking up the board to keep some other child from making the same mistake. Or maybe it was the lawyer's impulse towards the collection of evidence, as my impulse had been the removal of the nail. That night at the dinner table, May could not stop telling us the story of our day. I had thought we should drive back into the city and go to the hospital there, but the Gilberts were worried about getting stuck in traffic, and so we wound up in an emergency room in Brooklyn, all of us sitting there tired and gritty with sand. The ER doctor gave Andy a tetanus shot and cleaned his foot, x-rayed and wrapped it. In our hasty departure from Brighton Beach, Mrs. Gilbert had left her cover-up behind, so had to sit in the waiting room, then talk to the doctor in her red swimsuit top with a towel wrapped around her waist. May told us all of this as if she were bringing back news from a foreign land. I doubt the Gilberts, whom we had dropped off at their apartment on the east side, would have appreciated her relentless reenactment. Having started her story in the middle, sea glass, scream, she doubled back to the beginning upon reaching the end. She then told us about our ride out to the beach, what each of us had had for lunch, and how the boys had gone right in to swim, even though they weren't supposed to go so soon after eating. She told us how she and Pip, who was Andy's sister and May's friend, had gone with me and Mr. Gilbert. Pip had just found a shell, May said darkly, when we heard the first scream. Enough, her mother said finally. We were there. Celeste was handing around a plate of cold chicken. She'd gotten too much sun and her pale skin had burned to a dark red, her shoulders and chest, her face. I could practically feel the heat coming off her. All of us were tired. You didn't ask Andy if you could touch his foot, May said to me, undeterred. You didn't even ask his parents. Don't you have to ask first?